So 'twas the week before Christmas. We're not going to be here next week, so everyone get your fill today.
No rational security next week.
No rational security.
Holiday hiatus.
Exactly. All your security will be irrational next week.
For the week of Christmas.
And maybe we'll start a little early.
What's everyone? Do you guys have fun plans?
Well, a friend is making me a special 2017 snow globe for the baby cannons to blow up.
A snow globe.
Yeah, because whenever.
Why do you hate Christmas?
No, so whenever I do.
Why do you hate snow globes?
No, it's whenever I do a Twitter, you know, take requests for what to blow up for baby cannon. People always want a snow globe.
Really?
Yeah, and we've looked and looked for the appropriate snow globe, but we feel that the appropriate one would be one that represents the year 2017 somehow. And so we haven't been able to find the appropriate one. So my friend Autumn wants to make one. And so she's hard at work making a 2017 snow globe. And the baby cannons are quivering with excitement.
Wow.
So I'm okay with this, but the metaphor of a big explosion at the end of the year is worrorsome to me, given
it's going out with a bang.
You may be tempting fate, Ben.
I'm thinking North Korea.
No.
Bob Mueller gets fired on Christmas Eve.
No, Christmas Eve massacre. It's just that 2017 sucks, and we should blow it up.
Hello and welcome to Rational Security, the Beam Me Up Santa edition. I'm Shane Harris, Christmas reporter. It is my favorite time of year, you guys.
It is. It's a nice time of year.
I love Christmas. I love the holidays. I love the season.
I love an empty Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's actually so much nicer.
It's my favorite time to stay in town is when everyone else is gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's good. We have this tradition of going around walking on Christmas night and seeing all the lights, and the city is just dead on Christmas night. It's kind of eerie, but it's like everyone's in their house and it's all warm and the lights are on, but there's really no one on the streets.
I'm going to be so sad when Christmas is over, because using Santa as a disciplinary threat is going to go away, and like I have been heavily relying.
All right, so wait, give us an example.
Like I if you don't get in your bed, I pull out the phone and I'm like, oh, I got to text Santa, because, you know, you are honor bound to be. It's full disclosure between parents and Santa guys. It's not my choice. And if you put me in a difficult position, it's like I have to tell the truth.
So Santa is your oversight authority, about
good and bad behavior. And like, look, I'm sorry, you're putting me in an incredibly bad position right now.
Okay, so here's the question, Susan. How many times have you played this card?
Hundreds. Honestly, I don't know how I'm going to parent without it.
Wow.
And it works every time.
So, like, when did you start? Like, in August?
like right after Thanksgiving. He needed the visuals of Santa being around. Originally, the advent calendar candy was, like, a strong enough incentive/deterrent. But he has outgrown that, so we needed a heavier.
You had to escalate. It's the turn the screw approach to coercive diplomacy.
So in
season 10.
And that is the true meaning of Christmas.
So, like, growing up Jewish, this is, like, all new to me.
I don't know how you guys ever got your kids to do anything.
Because the gifts come directly from the parents.
Much more direct. Forget this outside force.
Yeah.
Speaking of outside forces, this week on the podcast.
Oh, you were just waiting to say that.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for this week. Robert Mueller gets hold of emails from the presidential transition. The Pentagon has been researching sightings of UFOs.
As it should.
I'm going to repeat
Shane
that.
And Tammy
the
are
Pentagon
so excited,
has been researching sightings of UFOs.
And the Daily podcast had an incredible account of that story.
It was amazing.
Which you really need to listen to.
We're going to get to this.
Yeah.
And a U.S. citizen is being held as an enemy combatant in Iraq, plus an object lesson. It's a special object lesson. We're going to talk about the stories and moments that we think didn't get enough attention in 2017 because Russia. So speaking of Russia, so Robert Mueller, the special counsel, has apparently gotten hold of a huge tranche of emails that were used by members of the Trump transition on a GSA server. So these are PTT.gov, presidential transition team.gov emails. Pretty immediately, the Trump lawyers threw a fit about this for all kinds of reasons, saying that there were attorney-client privilege violations. That were
bullshit!
Well, Tamar.
I'm not even a lawyer, and I know that.
We pitched you first on this one.
So you guys, I'm in the room, and I am an attorney, so this is all privileged conversation.
Oh, thank God.
I like this. So the legal argument, it's multifaceted, but essentially is that Mueller has overreached here. He had no real authority to go to the transition and obtain these emails. This prompted a rare response from the special counsel's office, in which they said rather curtly, whenever we get information like this, we do it with pursuant to legal authority or criminal procedure. Let's take the legal element of this, and then let's talk about the politics and the sort of strategy of the Mueller investigation and the opportunity that this gives Trump to push back on it. So, Susan, there's been some really good writing on Lawfare actually this week about this. I mean, does the argument hold water that Bob Mueller did not have any authority to get these emails and that they're covered by privacy or presidential communications privilege or attorney-client privilege?
Yeah, so once again, we're in a position where the Trump team or some element of the Trump team, and keep in mind, you know, the Trump transition is one entity, the Trump White House is one entity, the Trump organization, the campaign is something different. So we're talking about the sort of the Trump transition here. They're offering sort of a half-baked legal argument and not a particularly well-articulated legal argument. And so that makes it a little bit difficult to sort of say this is unequivocally wrong and sort of point to the precise areas where it's wrong, because it's sort of like, well, you're saying this thing, it's really hard to sort of track the logic. Sort of based on the letter which was sent to Congress, you know, their essential argument is that even though they were using government devices, that this was, though it was covered by an MOU, a memorandum of understanding between GSA and the Trump transition, there was some kind of representation that these documents or anything, any content information that was exchanged using these devices was going to be treated as private.
The transition, we should say, is a private organization. All transition teams are.
Exactly. It's essentially a nonprofit organization that is partially funded by the government. So a little bit of sort of a nebulous thing. It appears that the MOU actually expressly states that there is no expectation of privacy, that they will cooperate with law enforcement. It sort of, the letter intimates that there was some kind of different oral representation about whether or not these would be private. I think really sort of the tell here that this is not a serious legal argument is that these complaints were directed at Congress. The letter is actually not really making, they use terms like unlawful, but it's actually not challenging the fact that Mueller obtained these emails. It's saying, hey, Mueller did this thing, we're really unhappy about it, and we think Congress should enact future law and policy to protect future presidential transitions. So it appears that what happened is Mueller's team requested documents from the Trump transition. They produced several hundred documents in response, sort of several hundred responsive emails. In the course of interviewing witnesses, the witnesses realized that somehow Mueller's team had not just the emails that they had produced, but all of the emails, right? So that sort of tipped them off to, hey, wait a minute, they're actually working off a complete.
And there's some delta, perhaps, it seems, maybe between those two.
Some significant delta.
Exactly. And a significant delta about whether or not the team has actually responded fully and completely to it. So it appears that that was sort of the episode that spooked or irritated the Trump for America team. And now they're making this sort of policy argument to Congress that really it was immediately leaked to Fox News. It seems pretty clear that this is kind of a PR stunt talking point. Now, embedded in that, there are potentially interesting Fourth Amendment questions. Well, a private public entity, and how does this interact? And Orrin Kerr has written on Lawfare sort of saying, yeah, it looks like there's nothing there, but let's not so fast, and let's actually sort of, as a fun academic exercise, think through these issues. But no, from what I can see, there is no serious legal argument here. I don't even see the Trump for America team really claiming that there's a serious legal argument here.
Yeah, so I think that's all very likely correct. If you have a serious legal argument that a prosecutor is behaving improperly or that a government agency is behaving improperly in complying with a prosecutor's subpoena or production request, you generally take it to the supervising court and the chief judge of the relevant court, which would be the district, the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. You generally don't go to a committee without jurisdiction over the a committee of Congress that doesn't have jurisdiction over the relevant investigation. And I think the fact that they did it in that fashion suggests that they're probably the audience is something other than, you know, the people really concerned about the legalities or people in a position to do something about whatever illegality there may have been. I will say that when you use a government computer or device, you generally don't do it with the assumption that there are deep privilege issues from a criminal investigator or that there are big Fourth Amendment concerns about that being turned over. You're not the owner of the material. You generally don't have an expectation of privacy in that regard. You know, certain FBI agents found that out the hard way recently. And I'm not sure why the Trump transition is especially differently situated from that.
I think that's actually that last point about what happened to the FBI agents on the Mueller team whose texts were exposed is worth focusing on, not for the specific contrast, but for the choice of Trump's lawyers and allies to make an issue of this at the same time that they are clearly embracing exposure of other people's information that, you know, might be exposed not pursuant to appropriate process. And also that they're claiming privacy rights on information that, you know, that was part of the transition, just as they've insisted on a right to shroud in secrecy the president's tax returns, his business dealings. You know, it's just it's a very consistent effort to say this man, Donald Trump, and his family and their stuff is not stuff that the American people have a right to know about. And this is just another example of that. But, you know, the more we're talking about acts that are in some sense official acts and a transition, although it is technically a private entity, it exists pursuant to law. It's funded by the government. It uses government equipment and facilities. It's not really a private entity. So even if you want to make those claims about the Trump organization, the business, even if you want to stretch that to include a campaign for president of the United States, the idea that you can extend that to the transition or to people who are sitting in the White House is crazy. And yet they keep extending this argument farther and farther.
So, I think that is a really important point and not one that I've heard many people make. This notion of they still want to operate as though they're a private entity and sort of that, you know,
right, that Donald Trump is some private individual. He's not actually sitting in public office with any accountability to the public.
Right. Even the way they talk about leaks, right? So obviously leaks of classified information, you know, that's a separate issue. But just the way they talk about, you know, the fact that their deliberations and what's going on in the White House would appear on the, like sort of there's the hostility to transparency. It really is sort of at odds with sort of basic principles of civic service that, you know, there's transparency, there's accountability to the public, that this is, you know, the public has an interest in knowing these things.
So let's step away from the kind of the ethics and the legalities of what's happening and look at this as a political action, because this is really the first time, I think, that Trump's lawyers have in a big way, concerted kind of public way, pushed back on Mueller and where he's going. And what's notable about this is it's coming at a time when the president's lawyers are saying, we've been completely forthcoming. We're more than happy to give Bob Mueller what he wants. We think it's going to be wrapped up. We've talked in the podcast before about why that seems
it's going to be wrapped up in a few weeks. And it's outrageous that GSA turned over this material.
Right. But this creates now, it seems to me, a new point of traction. And I wonder if it portends what I think a lot of people, particularly those of us who've been covering this, have been wondering is there's going to come a moment where essentially the White House is not going to play nice anymore and is going to start pushing back and saying that Bob Mueller is the investigation's going off the rails. I mean, the texts of the FBI agent have been another sort of bit of ammunition that the Trump team has been using in that.
Yeah, so I think that this is a place in which it is really important to sort of keep the teams and the legal teams separate. So the Trump for America legal team is separate from the Ty Cobb White House team. It's separate from the president's personal counsel. They have represented that there was no coordination with the White House, right? They are just, they are representing the campaign, the transition interests, and have actually expressly said, you know, we didn't talk to the White House. This is just sort of what we're doing. I do agree that it's a political play and sort of that there's political consequences that all lead to, can he fire Mueller? I do think there's kind of a dual track going on here, right? So like that inner circle, the part that's the sort of closest to the president, that it's most advantageous to sort of have that plausible deniability to be able to say, hey, look, we're totally cooperating with this investigation. We've opened the robe. We have nothing to hide here. At the same time, being perfectly comfortable with people a little bit further out sort of starting to make the case. So I don't know that we're going to see a pivot from sort of that like very close in team or the president's actual lawyers. We might. I do think that, you know, they're going to be meeting this week or next week. I think we might see sort of a turn in that. But I don't see these things as necessarily at odds. I think the interesting thing is to what degree is there actual coordination as opposed to just kind of people reading the landscape and strategizing off of that.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly a broader set of interests, both inside the administration, around the administration, and beyond that in the sort of pro-Trump political universe that, you know, they all have an interest in denigrating the neutrality and authority of the Mueller investigation and painting it as a politicized operation that's out to get the president. And so I don't think you need a coordinated conspiracy to explain this behavior. And I think it's clear that there are people in the sort of right-wing media universe and political operatives and so on who are just reading each other's signals and echoing one another in the way that happens all the time on all kinds of issues. What really struck me over the last week in the wake of this this non-scandal about the emails from the transition was how quick people on the left and opponents of the president were to read this as a coordinated conspiracy and to read into it, oh, Trump is getting ready to fire Mueller. And, you know, it strikes me that you really don't need to go there to understand this. Number one, the simplest explanation is that they all have an interest in having the Mueller investigation being seen as political. But number two, you know, why is firing Mueller the sort of inevitable conclusion of this game? Even if there is some kind of coordinated game or strategy, why is firing Mueller the end game? It seems to me the end game is just a Mueller investigation that whatever it produces is seen on the right as illegitimate and a creature of the left. And the left, by rushing to the barricades to defend Mueller's integrity, is just playing right into that and making Mueller look like he's an agent of the left.
Yeah. Ben, what do you think about that? And we should say the White House has said repeatedly, vociferously, on the record, there is no discussion about firing Mueller, to the point where Mark Short, when asked about it, the legislative affairs director on the White House on Meet the Press on Sunday, was just like exasperated by this idea and essentially said, this is all a thing in your mind as journalists. This is not real. We're
not doing this. Every time a journalist asks them the question and they deny it, people who are opponents of the political opponents of the president get excited about the possibility, and it reinforces the whole dynamic.
Then Trump makes other comments that undercut it as well. Like, we'll see. I mean, he also is playing into this.
So I think the press actually deserves some blame here, and particularly the networks. The network talk shows on Sunday were rife with comments like, Washington is awash in rumors that the president is going to fire Mueller on Friday. And, you know, I heard this, you know, on multiple network TV talk shows over the weekend. Nobody had anything solid, and it was completely irresponsible to be reporting this as though it were something other than vapor. The White House, you know, obviously is engaged in an effort to delegitimize the Mueller investigation, even while they're actively talking about how they're cooperating and he's about to clear them all, or at least the president. But there was never a basis for their firing Mueller on Friday. This was an example of lots of press people not wanting to be behind, and so getting out in front of something that didn't have a factual basis. And the result was that the mainstream print press the next day on Monday had all of these stories about the comments that people were making about this rumor. And actually, both the New York Times and the Washington Post had this, you know, stories like, actually, he's not that focused on firing Mueller. He's really got it in for Rod Rosenstein. Yeah. And so
it was
this,
like, meta news coverage.
It was totally meta news coverage. There was never a basis for it. The TV talk shows overtly talked about it as, we're reporting rumors now, let's get everybody's comments. And then the print press reported as news the comments on all this stuff. So I think there's actually, it's pretty irresponsible. And there were relatively few people. One of them was Jack Goldsmith, who said, I don't see a basis for this. And I'm actually skeptical. So let me say this right now. I actually don't think this is about firing Bob Mueller, and I don't think it has ever been about firing Bob Mueller. I think what this is about is creating a atmosphere in which the future actions of the Mueller investigation are perceived by large swaths of the public as illegitimate or political or inappropriate. And by the way, that were partisan. And by the way, that is exactly what Bill Clinton's people did to Ken Starr. And it is exactly what Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush's people did to Lawrence Walsh. It is a tried and true crisis response by White Houses under criminal investigation to the investigators. It's an old playbook. And it doesn't mean you're going to fire the special prosecutor.
So I don't agree that it's sort of, I mean, I agree with the premise that, like, this is vapor, but I don't agree with the same sort of, like, this is completely irresponsible or irrational. I think you have to think about, we are in a very similar place in terms of the rhetoric that what occurred prior to the firing of James Comey, which was sort of weird signals out of the White House about being, being unhappy with the situation, speculation, and not a ton of overwhelming pushback, especially from the Hill.
Susan, there was no talk of, the Comey thing came out of nowhere. There was no talk of,
I don't think it came out of nowhere. There were substantial discussions, there were substantial questions immediately prior and after the inauguration about whether or not he was going to keep Comey, as though that was like a regular decision he was going to make. And then there were sort of, I think that there was a live or open question, or at least a sufficiently live and open question that we wrote about it on Lawfare, sort of why this would be such a substantial.
Well, we wrote about it the day after the election. Not because there were rumors about it, but because we thought that if you were going to interfere with law enforcement, you'd probably have to get rid of Jim Comey.
Sure.
That was a characterological assessment of Donald Trump.
Sure. So I don't – the point being that the Comey firing, that nobody had sort of set that marker. And whenever sort of early trial balloons went up in whatever form they went up about firing Comey, there was not sort of sufficient guardrails put in place. And so I do think it is reasonable that as you look at sort of Trump's sensibility, personality, the things that he is actually saying, and that Trump is personally saying – in the context of this clearly some kind of effort, whether it's coordinated or not, to impugn the legitimacy of the investigation, I do think it's reasonable for there to be an effort for people to really want to get people on record and set the markers now of how unacceptable this would be, why it would be a big deal, sort of to the extent that this is at all a trial balloon, either from the White House or from his surrogates, to shoot it out of the sky. I don't think that's a crazy or irresponsible thing.
So Shane is motioning us to finish up this segment, but I will just say I totally agree with that. But I think that's a different thing than saying Washington is awash with rumors that Mueller is going to be terminated on Friday. And to say that is to tease a news story that you actually don't know if it's true. You have no factual basis for. And if you knew, you wouldn't be talking about it in the language of rumors. You'd be saying something like, four sources with knowledge of the situation say that Trump plans to fire Mueller on Friday. And that's, you know, when the press doesn't talk in that language, we should ask the question, are people reporting stuff or are they just expressing anxiety by talking out of their asses?
Speaking of fake news stories, Shane.
Yeah, we're going to move on to the story that is seriously the only story I care about this week. So if you missed it, because you've been living on another planet, we mock what we don't understand.
I love this story very deeply.
I am not freaking out about this story.
So Helene Cooper at the New York Times and her colleagues ran this really amazing story that a special unit in the Pentagon funded at around $21 million a year, I think it was, in the black budget, thanks largely to the intervention of one former senator, Harry Reid. This unit was set up to investigate sightings of UFOs. Unidentified flying objects. And the upshot of this, after the guy who ran this unit went public, is that, at least in his view, and I think Senator Reid, who was also on the record with the Times, backed this up, believes that there is a large amount of credible information, sightings of flying objects of technology that the Defense Department and all of its bright minds cannot explain. That involves technology, in the words of the story, that appears to be beyond next generation. There have been apparently metal alloys obtained whose provenance we cannot determine. I don't know
why. Are there probes discovered in anyone?
And I want to say, you're proving the point, one of the points in the story, which is why this doesn't get discussed more, is because you sound silly or you sound like the X-Files. But I just want to underscore, if this were a private organization like SETI or a nonprofit, which makes Ben choke when he hears SETI,
just have a cough.
Signs of extraterrestrial life and whatever, intelligent life. You know, credible, but like outside groups that didn't have access, presumably, to classified information in the Pentagon would be one thing. This is a secret black budget Pentagon program that ran for years, whose former members are now saying on the record there is a mountain of stuff, of evidence, of technology that we cannot tie to any source that we know about. That's the Pentagon saying this, which I think takes this story actually out of the realm of, you know, Project Blue Book stories and Area 51. You've now actually got a recently
active... Hey, don't knock Area 51.
Yeah, I'm not knocking at all, but it just seems extraordinary to me that this is a reasonable group of people coming forward and saying, we've collected information, we have the ability to compare it to, you know, all of our super secret stuff because we're in the Pentagon. And P.S., if the government were building a flying object like the one that is described on the record by this F-18 pilot in the story, there's no way you could keep that secret. Let's just stipulate that. You know, WTF, you guys, there's evidence of aliens.
Okay, so I think
not evidence of aliens, but
I think it's right. So we have to. I think like the part where it gets silly is the jump from unidentified to extraterrestrial.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
so clearly,
yeah.
So one.
So you think that the Chinese have developed a 40-foot-long object that can hover?
A large tic tac.
I don't know. I think
I'm pretty sure they haven't. But okay.
It would certainly be grotesquely irresponsible for the Pentagon to not be, thoroughly investigating any sort of reports.
Yes.
And it would be a really negative thing if sort of the stigma about having seen an alien or being crazy caused, you know, members of the military or scientific community of not sort of to report things that they couldn't explain out of fear of sort of being stigmatized. So look, I don't actually have any conclusion on the, like, intelligent life angle, although maybe that's what your helicopters are all about. Well, they're the black helicopters circling us. There are two parts of this story that I actually think are really significant and are not related to extraterrestrial
life. We're
not
talking about those.
So the very first, I know, Shane is like, no, we're talking about aliens, guys.
I'm totally up for talking about aliens.
Back so the to the
first
point.
One is the disclosure that comes way, way, way at the second to last paragraph that is talking about these various Defense Department officials that have decided to come forward with this story, in which they say, they are now joined in a new commercial venture called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. They're speaking publicly about their effort as their venture aims to raise money for research into UFOs. So a little bit of context that these people are trying to raise money, and that I think is relevant context to the story. The other, frankly, a little bit shocking part of the story, and one that Harry Reid is actually on the record about, is that Harry Reid had $22 million of the black budget dedicated to this project. Which
to a single company run by a friend.
Right? a secret part of it known only to a few other members of a particular committee that was entirely controlled by his friend. That is like, sort of seems like a public corruption issue. So I actually think that is, you know, whether or not this research is meritorious, I don't know why we wouldn't be investigating sort of any serious national security questions, of which unidentified objects should be one. But why exactly this apparently non-compete, no-bid contract was awarded to this one random person, I think raises
some Area 51
really
is in Nevada.
Well, okay, so I agree. I actually found some of what was glorious about this story was the combination of the outside what we know and the business as usual in Washington. The local hotel magnate who goes to his senator and says, I have a great idea. We should be investigating unidentified flying objects, and I'm the man to do it. I just thought was fantastic. But if you want to add a little bit of the conspiratorial, note that of the few senators who were aware of this black budget sole source contract, two are dead. and they
coincidence?
Died.
I don't think so.
Exactly.
Have the bodies been recovered?
Now,
wait. I have another question about this, though.
Yeah.
So Donald Trump represents America, an America First agenda. But if the entire world is going to have to unite to confront these unidentified flying objects, does that raise an Earth First agenda?
Why would we unite with the rest of the Earth? The rest of the Earth can deal with themselves. And, but America.
Competitive engagement, Ben. It's in the national security strategy.
But if we have an Earth First agenda here, does the environmental group called Earth First do we have a problem with the nomenclature? What happens when...
Oh, Ben, you're...
Now you're arguing over trademark, right?
Yeah, exactly. Seriously.
E.T. is among us.
We're talking about unexplained phenomena. Okay. And I do have to just say, it's mostly phenomena, Shane, not technology. Like, okay, the alloys, I grant
no,
you.
No.
But
no.
But
okay,
the things that the pilot saw...
It was
are...
a big tic-tac.
No.
Like, sailors saw unexplained phenomena in the atmosphere for years before science figured out what they were. So these two pilots saw a flying Tic Tac.
Okay. It was a really big Tic Tac.
I'm going to push back on this one strongly, and okay. I agree with you. That's true.
What flavored Tic Tac?
But those sailors did not have the benefit of...
Ben is not taking this seriously.
Ben is just setting this up. Oh, I'm all about
you guys,
it.
Shane is really deadly serious
I'm
right
so
now.
I'm so serious. I know I'm like the happy-go-lucky moderator, but God damn it, I'm putting my foot down this one. No, but here's what I push back on this. So there is, you know, telemetry data, there is radar data, there is visual witnesses, there is videotape. Whatever this thing was, it was witnessed by the two pilots. I think there was actually two planes. It's caught on tape. It's being tracked by a ship in the area that is watching it go from 80,000 feet, plummeting to 20,000, shooting back up to 80,000 feet again in a way that no known object or phenomena behaves.
Tic-tac.
Tic Tacs are really maneuverable.
It's 40 feet long, Ben.
It's not a Tic Tac. Like a weird pile of Canada geese. I mean, we don't know.
And how do you explain the speeds at which do geese fly like 4,000 miles an hour?
I don't object to it being research. I don't think it's a scandal that the Pentagon would be spending this money or that this program would exist, right? I actually think it would be irresponsible if something like that did occur and people were just like I don't want to talk about this. But it's the jump. It still feels like we're making a logical
No one's making a jump.
Here.
No one's saying this is proof of aliens, except maybe. But maybe I just want it to be. But like, I find it, you know, what I think separates this story, and I'm being completely serious here, from stories that have been before, is you have a Pentagon agency, very well funded, and I know that the money went to this private sector individual, but who also appears to have a fairly robust investigative kind of group here. We have so much knowledge of aviation systems. We have so much knowledge of weather phenomena. We have so many instruments with which to measure things today. And the experts that are looking at this are coming back and saying, we don't know what this thing is. And in the podcast that Ben mentioned in The Daily, they asked this guy for who ran the office, is there more information that you're not at liberty to discuss? And he said, yes. And Harry Reid on the record said the same thing. I don't think anybody's saying this is proof of aliens, but they are saying there's this compelling mountain of technological evidence that we are technologically gathered evidence that we cannot explain. We don't know what it is.
So do
That's
you think that,
a really surprising statement.
Do you think that DOD should be more forthcoming? I mean, right? So, okay, there's this program. Now we know. Obviously, it's reported in the New York Times. It does exist. There's a body of information. There's evidence that is credible enough for a DOD inquiry. Like, what do? Bring in outside scientists? Make it all public for
crowdsourcing?
Put it in the public domain? What do you think is, like, the appropriate...
Unless there... Look, I struggled as we were preparing for this. I really challenged myself to say, what is the legitimate national security reason you could imagine classifying the findings of this program? And the only one that I could really imagine settling on is you've credibly determined that this is actually some hostile force of an unknown origin that is here to try to do harm, and we have no way to defend against it, and we don't want to cause a public panic. But if embarrassment is the reason, that's not a good reason.
No. I think there's a simpler reason, which is that if there's technology that creates capability for flight, for example, for aerial manipulations that we don't have,
right?
But say it has a human source, you know, then that could be a threat to our national security.
But who could that possibly be?
The Swiss.
The Swiss.
But look, there clearly
If we didn't build this thing, if this is human built, it's ours. And I just can't imagine you could keep that secret. No one else has the capability to build something like this.
I don't know.
I don't think that's necessarily true.
Really?
I mean, look at the other countries that are, like, you know, significant, have significant space programs. I mean, I do think that actually the reasonable assumption would be if you observe an object that you don't, you know, that you don't understand where it came from or you don't understand the technology, assuming it is, you know, Occam's razor, a human source, assuming that it is funded by the government,
the Tic Tac
that you've brought up some kind of, you know, that it's some sort of surveillance plane, something like that. I could imagine once you have eliminated those possibilities, then saying, okay, we should say that this is just a scientific phenomenon, not a national security one. But I do think that, like, if you observe these things, the sort of first assumption should be that it's national defense information, that it should be protected, and probably that we should assume there's a human explanation.
We have to sadly move on from this, but I want to jump on that point. You tell me, as the former national security lawyer,
there are aliens in the basement.
If this actually were, let's just say it were some kind of tech, I mean, I'm not doubting this, but like, let's say this were a U.S. designed system. In which case, if there is, why are we not living on Mars? Because we can do amazing things. But if that really is some sort of hugely advanced kind of system that was kept even from the people who were in this Pentagon office, why would you fly it around within range of American fighter aircraft and ships where it could be tracked to a fare-thee-well? Why would you do that?
Because lots of people need mint you know,
you are not part of this discussion anymore.
Cut his mic. Go sit in the corner.
Vanessa, cut him off.
There are these very large people that need a large detector.
I think it's a really good question, Shane, which is why I would assume that if it's flying around near American fighter jets, it's probably not American. It's probably from some other state that didn't know where our fighter jets were, and they're just trying to test their thing out and take the chance that they're not going to get found. I have to say, part of what I love about this story is that the guy who used to run this program in the Pentagon on the contract, in hooking up and creating this new corporation called To the Stars, which is such a lovely notion, because they say they're gonna prove exotic technologies exist that could revolutionize the human experience. But I love that basically he's hooked up with a hotel magnate and a rock star, the vocalist for Blink-182, which is a band I really like. So on that basis, Shane, I'm with you. Let's go find the exotic alien technology. These are our pioneers, you guys.
Earth first, man.
If there was one group that I thought could have a serious discussion about this.
We're sorry to disappoint you yet again.
Yeah, it's all right. I think you're all secretly with me and just don't want to admit it.
It's the Chinese, man. I'm telling you.
If the Chinese have a 40-foot tic-tac that can do these things, we are screwed.
It's the Swiss.
The Swiss are fine. They're harmless. It's a chocolate machine. All right. Let's move on to an actual serious topic. This goes in the category probably of things that we did not discuss enough and have really not gotten enough attention. But a U.S. citizen, we should say a U.S. citizen with dual Saudi citizenship, has been held for, I think it's 14 weeks now.
It's amazing.
As an enemy combatant in Iraq. These are citing media reports. The administration has withheld the identity of the detainee who's being called John Doe while it figures out what to do with them. And reportedly, Syrian forces captured him in mid-September while he was fighting with ISIS in Syria and Iraq. And then he was turned over to the military and has sort of been in this legal gray area ever since. So my first question, and Ben, maybe you want to take this, is that I thought we had a fairly well-used, well-worn method for when we detain an enemy combatant in certain circumstances. You can evaluate them with the interrogation team for a certain period of time without reading them their rights. But then, you know, you eventually bring them into custody, and there's a process for this, or so I thought. So why is this person, do we think, being held incommunicado for going on 4 months now?
Okay, so the possibility of a case like this has always been there, and we've been lucky so far in it not materializing. So in the Hamdi case in 2004, the Supreme Court affirmed that it was lawful to detain a U.S. national in military custody under the authorization for the use of military force. But it said that he had to have some kind of legal process. But it didn't say when that process really kicks in. Since then, both the Bush administration, but particularly the Obama administration, were pretty careful not to try to hold U.S. citizens, at least new U.S. Detainees, in this status again. And so we've generally routed people pretty quickly into the criminal justice system. Sometimes there's a lag where you interrogate people, but generally speaking, you capture people and pretty quickly they end up in New York, in the Southern District of New York, in facing criminal indictment. There was always this possibility that, well, what if you arrested somebody or captured somebody who met the standard in Hamdi, that is, who's a lawful detainee under the laws of war, but you couldn't make an easy criminal case against for one reason or another, what would you do? And we've been quite lucky in that situation has not really arisen. And some of us have been warning for a number of years that it would eventually show up and we would have a bit of a crisis when it did. That is this case. Now, I think some of what the administration is doing here is not wholly unreasonable. For example, it is reserving the right to use the authority that the Supreme Court in Hamdi said it had. Some of what it's doing is quite unreasonable, which is insisting, first of all, withholding the guy's name so that he can't file a habeas case, preventing him from meeting with counsel who could represent him, and then arguing that the ACLU lawyers who are attempting to represent him are not proper representatives for habeas purposes because they don't have a relationship with him, of course, which they only don't have because the government won't let them meet with him and won't let him meet with them. So, you know, the hope was early on that this would be a short-term issue that would continue only until either he was brought to the United States for trial, as others in that situation have been, or transferred to his home government for reasons that aren't entirely clear. Neither of those has materialized, and it's turned into a kind of protracted incommunicado detention. And that's, quite troubling, particularly because the judge who's sitting on the case has not seemed like she's in a particular hurry to get it resolved in a fashion that's protective of his rights. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to see it resolved on any given day. You know, one day we'll find out he's been transferred to Saudi Arabia, or he'll show up in New York and the thing will evaporate. But I do think it is pretty disturbing the way it's played out so far.
Can I ask, so I think there are sort of two explanations or possible explanations for what's going on. One is that this is some kind of substantive decision, right? They've made the choice either to prolong or to push the limits, right? Really sort of push the limits of their legal authority, right? There's some reason why they're doing this. The other is that we've seen lots and lots of process failures, especially around the kind of sensitive national security decisions that might have had more legal input early on, right? I mean, it's a variation on your theme of malevolence versus incompetence. We don't have a DOD general counsel confirmed. You know, we only recently got a head of NSD. Is your gut instinct, and obviously this is more speculation, that what we're seeing here is evidence of some kind of substantive, policy decision within the administration? Or is your gut that just something funky is happening here? And yes, it's a problem that the timing is so wrong, but you think the ultimate explanation is just going to be they couldn't decide or get their act together?
Well, and can I add on to that question? Because I think the judge's willingness to give the government so much room here is bizarre, or at least demands a bit of explanation. And to me, that would lean in the direction of there being some substantive reason that maybe the judge is privy to and the rest of us are not.
Okay, so I think that is almost certainly not the case. The judge seems very impatient with the government's position on the as it is articulated, and has all but announced that she's going to rule against the government quickly, but then hasn't done so. And so I think it is just that she does not feel the kind of urgency about the matter that some people on the outside, particularly Steve Vladek at the University of Texas, seems to feel about it. In response to Susan's question, I assume that this is not an ideological thing at all. That is, nor is it necessarily a creature of incompetence. This could very well be, and I think most likely is, a situation in which you don't have a criminal case to make for one reason or another. The guy's been smart enough not to confess to criminal activity. There's some problem with treating it as a criminal matter. So you're not apt to bring him to New York and charge him with material support for ISIS. Transferring people to foreign custody when you're dealing with regimes that don't respect human rights is always hard. It takes years sometimes to get rid of Guantanamo detainees. And so these cases involve, you know, get very complicated very quickly. And if the Saudis are not saying all the right things and making all the right commitments, the transfer to of a U.S. citizen to foreign custody can be a very, very tricky problem. And I think what they're trying to do, and this is the only part on which I fault them, is they're trying to buy themselves time to get that done by not litigating the habeas case. And the keeping the stuff secret is a way of not getting to any merits questions associated with the habeas case, which in turn buys you time to deal with the Saudis to get him home.
But is that, I mean, this is a dumb question, but is that not a due process violation? I mean,
in and of itself, yeah.
So the questions that they are raising are on their own terms legitimate questions that are holes in the traditional fabric that we have for these habeas cases. And I can go into that technically
it's
if you want.
It's a lacuna in the law.
It's a genuine set of open questions that they are exploiting. I think it is wrong for them to be exploiting them in the way that they are. But I can't say that these are legal arguments that are not even available to them to make. And I do fault the judge for not, I mean, if to the extent that she doesn't agree with them, for not ruling promptly.
So I, setting aside the legal questions for just a minute and looking at this through the lens of diplomatic relations, the question of why he hasn't been transferred to Saudi custody, I find puzzling. First, we have transferred others to Saudi custody. So we have managed to get from the Saudis sufficient assurances with respect to humane treatment that we could make these other transfers. So why wouldn't they do it in this case? And A, and B, given that the bilateral relationship between the Trump administration and the Saudis is so intense, there's constant high-level contact, and we have, you know, scaled-up intel cooperation, scaled-up military cooperation. We're talking about all this stuff at all these different levels. Why hasn't this been handled? So I think, you know, either there's something about this case that makes it harder for one or the other or both sides. Like maybe this guy's from a very prominent Saudi family and it would be really embarrassing for the Saudis. Or maybe, you know, he has some tie to the United States that makes it particularly difficult for us to transfer and rely on Saudi assurances. Or, you know, maybe, as you said, Susan, it's just a process failure or a degree of incompetence on the part of the Trump administration.
Or Shane's alien thing.
Oh, of course. That must
just
be
putting it.
It
out there.
That's who John Doe is?
I mean, I will say this. I don't know the answer to that question, and I assume there's something about this case that we don't know. But, you know, those can cut both ways. Back when I was writing editorials for The Post, shortly after 9/11, there was it was also a Saudi case of a U.S. citizen who was arrested in Saudi Arabia, and you know, basically held in incommunicado detention by the Saudis. And he filed a habeas case. A guy named Abu Ali. He was from Virginia, and he filed a habeas case in U.S. court, arguing that the FBI was sort of behind the Saudi arrest of him and detention of him. And some of us got very concerned about what he was alleging. And I wrote a number of editorials expressing concern about whether the U.S. government had basically had a U.S. citizen locked up. And then he suddenly showed up in U.S. District Court in the United States. And what he was charged with was being an Al-Qaeda operative who had planned the assassination of President Bush. And he was eventually convicted and sentenced to life in prison. And there was a very, very serious criminal case behind it. So I don't want to be, I don't think that's what's going on here, but I don't want to prejudge the question of what we don't know. I'm very uncomfortable with a protracted detention without his name being released and with the government actively trying to frustrate his habeas review.
I think it must be because he's an alien.
It's the simplest explanation.
One can hope. Let's move on to object lessons. This week, as we said, we're going to talk about
identified object lessons.
Identified object lessons. Shame. When our alien overlords are here.
You are not invited into Shane's bunker. And it is very tastefully decorated.
They will be looking. That's right. They will be looking for the ones who didn't doubt to be their ambassadors. We're going to talk about briefly just stories we thought that either stories or moments that we thought didn't receive enough attention. I'll go first. Something that I'm just. It didn't receive no coverage, obviously, because, you know, we covered it. Colleagues of mine covered it at the Journal. I was very surprised that the Section 702 debate was not a bigger story.
What's that? What's that,
yeah,
you say?
That again? Section who? So we've talked about it on the podcast, but obviously Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act is sunsetting at the end of the year. And as we've explained here before, it's the
also known as the end of next week.
End of next, that too. It is essentially the piece in the law that authorizes intelligence collection that forms the bulk of what the president sees every day. Sort of it's a major, if not the kind of dominant conduit, if you will, for foreign intelligence gathering in the intelligence community. And I'm just surprised that the debate around reauthorizing it, the contours of that, the civil liberties components of it, the government's compelling interest as they see it in keeping the law going. This is a big deal. It was a big deal when it was enacted in 2008. It was a major change to how the intelligence agencies operate for civil libertarians. Many of them saw it as a fundamental reshaping of privacy controls and in many ways an abuse of the government's surveillance authorities. Given all of those stakes, you wouldn't really know it by the relative lack of coverage around it. And that just kind of surprised me.
No, I totally agree. And I do think, I mean, we still have another week and a half. So we'll see if the White House manages to pull it off. But I do think that if they don't manage to reauthorize before it lapses on the 31st, this is a creature of legislative dysfunction, but it is mostly a creature of White House dysfunction. And so this will be a real policy scandal and embarrassment for a White House that has gone all in on this rhetoric of national security and radical Islamic jihadism and sort of this silly stuff, and for them to allow an absolutely critical national security authority to lapse at the same time that they're criticizing the mayor of London for not using the right words would just be an incredible black eye.
Just very briefly, if it does lapse, if the statute lapses, does that mean the surveillance that was authorized stops, or is there...
So April 26th, 24th is the day in which the annual authorizations will expire. So in all likelihood, and we can talk about it on a later podcast, existing collection would be able to continue up until that date, although you couldn't seek new authorization. So they're sort of think of it as a secondary cliff that's going to come in April.
Right. Okay. Who wants to go next?
I will go next. So mine is also like yours, Shane. It's not something that wasn't reported. It was something that didn't get sort of the penetration, the sort of the cultural awareness that I really thought it was going to. And this is sort of the intersection between the ethics and transparency issues of the Trump administration and national security. You know, we talked about it early on, sort of Trump's decision not to divest and Ivanka's decision and Jared's decision, right? This weird commingling of their personal financial interests, sort of their instinct towards, frankly, some sort of kleptocratic structure of things, and really, really important national security decisions. I think it overlaid so much of what occurred this year. Tammy, earlier you were talking about sort of the relationship with the Saudis, you know, the nature of the rhetoric with the Chinese. I mean, there's so much there that I think is, you know, would cause any reasonable American to say, are U.S. national security decisions being made exclusively and solely on the basis of what is in the best interest of the United States and the security interests of the United States, or is it being made because they are, or even in part being made, because it is in the financial interests of the president, his family, or friends? And I just think that that has infected and altered so much of what has occurred over the past 12 years, or 12 months, it feels like 12 years. And I'm while I think reporters have done a really diligent job of sort of trying to track down those stories and report them out, for some reason that seems to be one area, either because it's technical or financial or too complicated, just the public hasn't really sort of grasped or, you know, grabbed onto that idea as being a part of the erosion of our institutions, our national security institutions, that's worth really caring about.
So my undercovered story, I don't know that it's undercovered, but I do think it's under-discussed as a policy matter in Washington, is what's happening to the global war on terror. You know, inevitably and understandably, there's been a lot of focus on the fight against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. But now that that fight is winding down, it seems to me that there's not only space, but there's an imperative to debate more broadly where the U.S. military is engaged in counterterror operations all around the world, under what authority, to what end, working with whom, and how. And there's almost no discussion of this. There was a little bit sparked by the deaths in Niger in October of four U.S. forces who were operating there in a train and assist mission formally, but clearly they were doing more than train and assist in that particular instance, and the circumstances of those deaths are still not fully known and still under investigation by the Pentagon. But to me, that case kind of created a blip of coverage, and then it slipped again below the surface. There was one hearing this year on a discussion of a new authorization for the use of military force in the war on terror, one hearing, and it's gone. The conversation is over. Congress moved on, and we're not going to get a new AUMF anytime soon. And it strikes me that we are likely to see in the coming year and the coming years more deployment of U.S. Troops, mostly special operators, in small numbers in places all around the world, working sometimes with local governments, sometimes just with the acquiescence of local governments, and sometimes independently, in operations that are thought of as part of this broader global campaign. And, you know, our colleague and now president of Brookings, John Allen, has spoken many, many times about the notion that if we don't deal with the underlying vulnerabilities in these countries that enable these terrorist movements to take root and flourish and operate, we're going to be playing whack-a-mole on a global scale for years. And I fear that without more public discussion, that's where we're ending up.
Alien technology.
Oh, Ben.
You will not get off so
now
easy.
Now you're on Shane's naughty list.
He's going to get a lump of sand.
Is that really what you're bringing to the table?
I mean, Benjamin, you're the one who's been saying it's an important story. And I'm saying, look, if it is an important story, it's been undercovered the whole year until last week.
Until it was reported last week.
Yeah.
Not reported at all. That doesn't count.
Well,
it's all you're going to get.
We know now if Shane could construct his own beat, what it would be, the UFO beat.
Amazing. I'm going to find a way to do this, you guys. Hey, look, if the New York Times Pentagon correspondent can do it, I can do it.
There you go.
It's going to be a way.
I believe in you.
Helene Cooper has legitimized this. God bless you, Helene. Oh, that brings us to the end of the podcast, mercifully for some. Rational Security is a production of Lawfare. You can find the show page on the internet.
Because we've just given up
in
on
cyber
that.
Somewhere out there. You can follow us on Twitter at RATL Security. You can find us on Facebook. Please remember, when you download the podcast, leave us a nice review and a rating. It's the holiday season. It'll be a nice present for us and all of your fellow podcast listeners out there to help them find it.
We'll text Santa and tell him you left a nice review.
Indeed. Our
it's
audio
just about threats.
Yeah, it's just threats. If you don't leave a nice review, we're texting Santa.
Heading on my phone.
Our audio engineer this week is Vanessa Sauter. The show is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. Music this week by Chris Kringle and the Flying Tic Tacs.
We're just the Flying Tic Tacs.
The Flying Tic Tacs?
Yeah.
I was trying to give it a holiday theme. There's always a lead singer and a backup. You know how this goes.
Right.
It can't just be the Flying Tic Tacs. Much as you would like to just make it all that Flying
Tic Tacs. Helene Cooper and the Flying Tic Tacs.
Ooh, there you go. That would be a great band. Oh, I could see that in a second. On behalf of my sometimes friend Ben Wittes, Tamara Kovamidis, and Susan Hennessy, I'm Shane Harris. Happy holidays, everyone, and we will see you next year. Bye-bye.